We are so grateful that you all have included us in your annual conference. It's an honor to be here. These cats are hilarious. We love your preacher and his family. And we're hoping that the next couple days will just be, a real safe sort of envelope, a sacred pause for us to sort of reflect together on how can we build a better world, and how can we do that, I think, by nurturing a deep contemplative spirituality so that we can do good better. So I am, in our marriage, Felina's sort of the contemplative mystic, and I'm sort of I usually say pissed, but I won't, the angry activist. And sort of trying to find our footing together in that has sort of helped us navigate sort of a shared vocation over the past 20 plus years. You'll see very quickly that Felina's an excellent teacher, and I'm sort of a verbal illustrator. And so I like to usually begin some of these things with stories to try to reclaim the distance between our contexts. And so a couple years ago, I was on retreat with my spiritual director. We were at a Benedictine monastery outside of Omaha, Nebraska, where we live. There were a number of us who had gathered to sort of go through sort of an abbreviated experience of the Ignatian exercises. And my spiritual director, Father Larry Gillick, who was leading the retreat, told us this story. He had been visiting one of the Catholic elementary schools in the city, and he was having a conversation with a little third grade girl. And in mid-conversation, she realized, actually, that Father Gillick couldn't see. And so she blurted that out and interrupted him and yelled, "You're blind!" And that's true. When Father Gillick was an 8-year-old boy, he actually lost his sight. And so he sort of bent down a little bit in front of the girl and was like, "Honey, that's not a surprise to me." And she went from just sort of being caught off guard and astonished to real deep, deep sadness. And then she said, "You don't know what you look like." And Father Gillick was just sort of taken by it. I mean, that's sort of an insightful thing for a little kid to say, right? And before he could respond, she said, "You're beautiful." And I think that's probably similar to a lot of our journeys, right? We're blind. We don't know what we look like. And many of us need the so-called unlikely other to sort of speak the truth over us about what is true, that we are beautiful. And hopefully over the next couple days, God will give us new eyes to see some things that maybe we haven't seen before. God will open our ears to hear some things that maybe we've not heard, not been capable or willing or available to listen to. And hopefully this will be a time of, I think, for some of us, renewal, and I think for others of us, sort of recalibration. And so for a little more context, like your preacher said, Flea and I have spent the past 20 years living and working with an international community in different parts of the world, sort of bearing witness to hope. And when I say bearing witness to hope, what I mean is that we live in a world that has legitimate reasons to question the possibility of God's goodness. But some of us still make that option for the absurd. Some of us still believe that God is good. And many of our friends' prayers actually continued to go unanswered. And so in that bearing witness to hope, we wanted to make ourselves available to those prayers. And so in solidarity, we moved into slums and refugee camps. We moved into areas where there were red light districts. And we helped children, primarily women and children, who had been trafficked into the commercial sex industry, into prostitution, find alternatives for employment, for providing for themselves and for their families. We worked with a lot of families who'd been impacted by the global AIDS pandemic, and so lots of little kids who are orphaned because their parents had died from AIDS, and lots of little kids who were born HIV positive, and as you can imagine, many of those children aren't with us today. We worked with a lot of children who were forced to fight in civil wars, and we worked with populations of youth that lived in sewers, on the streets, and refugee camps. We did this very prayerfully. We did this very quietly. It was very undramatic work. But it was a gift. It was a real honor to be part of it. And what we saw in 20 years of that work were a few common things about people who are trying to build a better world. Now, number one, a lot of those folks, us included, and I imagine this is true for many of you, if you're a social worker, if you're an educator, if you're a parent, but a lot of folks actually did a better job of taking care of someone else than they did themselves, right? And there's sort of a breakdown in integrity and credibility when we live like that. We saw a lot of folks move to very difficult parts of the world, very under-resourced, underserved zip codes or neighborhoods, and have tremendous difficulty establishing roots. And so they sort of survived and lived from one visa run to the next, or one retreat to the next, or vacation from vacation. And a lot of them didn't stay, couldn't stay. And you know how that is if you live in a neighborhood where folks are trying to accompany your folks and your people and your community, and they just don't want to be there, it's sometimes actually better for them to leave, right? And then what we saw was a lot of people with really compelling, really beautiful vocational callings sort of perpetually teeter on the edge of burnout. And in fact, a lot of these folks did burn out, and that was tragic. And when they burnt out, man, they crashed and burned hard, and lots of them walked away from their communities. Lots of them walked away from their vocational callings, and many of them actually walked away from, I don't like to say they walked away from their faith, because I don't think they gave up their faith. I think what happened was their beliefs did not sort of hold out, didn't provide the answers they thought they needed from them. And so reflecting back on that, experiencing some of this ourselves, we, a couple years ago, organized a Center for Contemplative Activism, a nonprofit called Gravity, sort of to help people who help people by grounding our social engagement in a deep contemplative spirituality so that we can move from this mere hope or notion of finding sustainability in vocation to actually thriving in vocation so that we could become awakened to our subconscious and our unconscious motivations for the good that we're trying to do in the world, and so that we can actually be, I think, critically reflective on the unintended harmful consequences of our best intentions. And so that's why we say do good better. It's confessional. We're still not going to do it great. We're still going to hurt ourselves. We're still going to hurt someone else. There's still going to be something that will catch up to us, and history won't absolve us. But if we can at least posture ourselves, position ourselves, ground ourselves, maybe we can just get a little bit further. And so what we really are going to do for the next couple days is introduce you to, I think, the historic Christian contemplative tradition. We're going to introduce you to some easy, simple practices for those of you who have active lives and have a hard time protecting or making time for solitude, silence, and stillness. I want to give you some tools that you can sort of tuck into your rhythms and include in your days, and hopefully give you new ways of seeing and new ways of hearing and new ways of praying. And a lot of these practices, because that's what they are, we like to call them disciplines. They're not disciplines until we practice them, right? But a lot of these practices, I think, are really essentially just sort of exercises for our soul. And so I'm sort of a chubby guy. I like cheese. But if I went to the gym as frequently as I should, I would try to do something that would include a number of different sort of routines to create some muscle confusion. And I think for some of us, maybe we need a little bit of muscle confusion in terms of how we're nourishing our spirituality. I think for some of us, maybe the ways that we used to pray, used to worship, maybe aren't meeting our needs or aren't working like they used to. And so hopefully some of these things that we can introduce you to will be helpful. I want to give a little bit more context before Felina comes up. But when we talk about solitude, silence, and stillness, I want to sort of highlight these because we're going to continue to come back to them. Solitude, silence, and stillness. Solitude, silence, and stillness is sort of the framework. And I think these are sort of corrections for the imbalance in our lives, right? Solitude. It's 2014, man. Everybody wants to be with someone all the time. So maybe some of you have like 9 roommates. Maybe some of you cannot go to the market by yourself. And if you do, you're on the phone with someone the whole time you're buying soup or whatever. It's hard for some of us to be alone. So we insulate ourselves with people, with friends, with family members, with coworkers. But sadly, some of us are still deeply and profoundly lonely. And solitude actually, right, teaches us to be present. To be present to those around us and to be present to the presence of God. Silence. Man, this is 2014, and there is a ton of noise in our lives. right? This is buzzing all day long. And it's Facebook, and it's Twitter, and it's text, and it's voicemail, and it's email, and it's Instagram. Whatever it is, if it's not buzzing all day long, I'm like walking around thinking I don't have reception because I've become addicted to the interruptions. And because of the addiction to the interruptions, a lot of us actually don't listen well. We don't know how to listen. But silence teaches us to listen, right? And stillness. Man, everybody wants to build a better world. Everybody is cause-driven in 2014. We want to combat human trafficking. We want to secure clean drinking water for folks in sub-Saharan Africa. We want to, whatever it is, and these are good things, and these impulses, I think, come from good places. But in 2014, it's like everybody is branded with the cause that they care about. And there are more nonprofits, I think, today than probably there ever have been and maybe ever need to be. But stillness, stopping, reflecting, allowing space for awakening teaches us how to engage, right? So solitude teaches us presence. Silence teaches us to listen. Stillness teaches us to engage. And I think over the next couple days, hopefully we can sort of let these things wash over us as we practice some prayers together and as we reflect on how we nurture our spirituality, the demands of our active lives in a world that needs folks who can continue to bear witness to hope. So with that, Felina is going to come up and sort of introduce a little bit more of this to us. And then we're going to close tonight with a prayer practice. Tomorrow we'll do a little bit more sort of teaching and illustrating. And then hopefully tomorrow night we'll have some space for some maybe conversation together about some of these things.
So I'd like to begin by inviting you to pray with me Psalm 46:10. The way we're going to do this is I will speak out, "Be still and know that I am God." And then you would repeat that back to me aloud, corporately, all together. And then the next phrase will be, "Be still and know that I am." And you'll repeat that back to me. And we'll do this in 5 consecutively diminishing sentences, ending with "be." And in this way, we'll just help ourselves become a little bit more present to the presence of God. And so I'll invite you to actually sit with both feet on the floor. And if you like, you can place your hands in your lap, palms up, maybe in a gesture of receptivity to the presence of God. Gently close your eyes and notice your breath as a way to connect your mind with your body and your heart. Notice how you feel in this moment. And then I'll invite you to repeat after me aloud. Be still and know that I am God.
Be still
and know that I am. Be still and know that I am. Be still and know.
Be still
and know. Be still. Be. Amen. It was a suffocatingly hot afternoon in West Africa's free town, Sierra Leone. 60% of the country was still controlled by rebel forces, but the 10-year war over blood diamonds was slowly coming to an end. Soldiers were being disarmed and brought into UN peacekeeping camps. Refugees from all over the country were pouring into the capital city, survivors of brutal amputation and children displaced from their parents. Both the government and rebel forces used amputation as a tactic of fear and control of the population. There seemed to be no mercy for this horrific demonstration of war. Young and old people alike were subjected to having one or both arms chopped off. In some cases, sons were forced to commit the grotesque act on their parents. The only consideration given for some was the audacious choice between short or long sleeve, indicating where the sever on the arm would take place. These brave and broken people struggled with basic daily chores like washing, dressing, and embracing their loved ones. Many of the men farmers needing both hands to work the land faced the despair of not knowing how they would ever provide for their families again. As if meeting the adult survivors of this brutality wasn't enough, I met children who also suffered under the wicked knife of their oppressors. One child was only 3 months old when the soldiers brutalized her. We met her when she was 2, struggling to open the shell of a peanut, using her one hand pressed against the nub of what was left of her other little arm. While at the camp for the war wounded, we met a number of teenage girls who wanted to share their story with us so the world would know what had happened to them. They were desperate for someone, anyone, to listen and do something to respond to their unbearable circumstances. So I bolstered up the courage and tried to bear witness to their pain. I heard detailed accounts of how the soldiers came to their village and rounded up their family and systematically raped and amputated the arms of their mothers and murdered their fathers. I heard how the soldiers then raped the young girls, often gang raped repeatedly, and forced them to be their war bride, meaning they'd be subjected to domestic and sexual slavery. As the girls recounted the sordid details through glassed-over eyes, some of them held their babies, offspring of the sexual violence they had endured. I left the camp in a daze. Before that day, I thought I'd seen it all. Prior to this visit to Freetown, I'd spent many years helping to establish communities of justice and hope. My husband and I had served all over the world among impoverished children with HIV and AIDS, youth living on the streets, and survivors of sex trafficking. But in all my experience with poverty and injustice, I'd seen nothing that compared to this kind of human brutality. In Sierra Leone, I looked for someone to blame: the government, the soldiers, the warlords whose greed led to such human atrocity. Certainly, there were systemic structures of injustice at play that were to blame, much like the systems of global economic disparity I'd grown familiar with. But as I recalled the stories of the soldiers who brutalized these young girls, I found individual human faces who were responsible and should pay for their crimes. Anger and judgment stirred in me toward the soldiers who had committed such unspeakable acts. And then I visited the camp for young soldiers who had just recently been disarmed. Boys of all ages and as young as 5 and 7 gathered together to meet with us. That's right, child soldiers. And like the young girls, they also wanted to tell their story. In moments, a few teenagers were brought to us. I thought, how could I bear to sit down with the soldiers who were responsible for the horrifying suffering of the girls I'd met just the day before? Somehow I did, and the boys began to recount similar stories of soldier invasions of their village and the murder of their parents and being conscripted into war. They remembered being drugged and forced to cut off arms and legs and to take up weapons that were too heavy for them to carry. And as the war dragged on, they remember being given girls to rape. It was all too much for me to bear. Soldiers, just children, forced to grow up under the parental authority of warlords. As I listened to my brothers, to the suffering they'd endured and the guilt they lived with, and as I remembered the agony of my sisters, the soldiers I'd so easily judged and convicted the day before were now sitting before me with a sea of pain in their eyes. It was now not so easy to demonize them. As my heart tore open, I wondered, who is responsible for all this human tragedy? And not just the tragedy of Sierra Leone, but who is responsible for all the pain and brokenness in the world? I wanted someone to blame. When I returned home to Omaha, I was recounting my experience in Freetown around my dining table, and after hearing these horrific stories, my friend looked at me and asked, "Do you ever doubt the goodness of God?" Immediately, tears welled up in my eyes, and it was like a confession for me. Yes, in those moments, I doubted the goodness of God. Having run out of people to project my judgment, I subconsciously and unconsciously directed my anger toward God. If people are basically victims, victimizing one another, and God created us, then surely God must answer for this. God must be to blame. I thought perhaps God is not so good after all. You see, in the face of human brutality and suffering, my religious paradigms began to crumble. I wonder, have you ever experienced something like this? I mean, have you ever known someone that you care deeply about that's been really hurt so badly that you wanted to find someone to blame? Someone to ascribe all your pain and suffering? Someone to answer for how you or others have been wronged? Or are the Sunday school answers for life that you learned as a child falling short in the face of 21st century social and political realities and challenges? Do you find yourself ever questioning God or the teachings of the church, wondering how your faith really makes a difference in the world, let alone in your own life? Nearly 10 years ago, upon returning from my first visit to Sierra Leone, my religious paradigms were severely challenged, and I didn't know where to turn. I didn't know how to relate to God in the midst of such tormenting doubts and questions. It wasn't long after that I met the Cistercian monk named Thomas Keating, and he introduced me to the Christian contemplative tradition and a practice called centering prayer. He taught me how to pray without words or thoughts. He taught me the way of what's known as pure prayer, being with God in authentic, naked self-surrender, just as I am with all of my personal brokenness and the brokenness of the world that I carry in my heart. Father Thomas says that at the point of religious conversion, we ask, "What can I do for God?" And this leads us to often do bold and courageous acts of love and service in the world. Father Thomas goes on to say that if we stay on the spiritual journey long enough, the spiritual practices that used to sustain us in our faith fall short. They don't support us like they used to. In essence, we find ourselves in the midst of a crisis of faith. The bedrock of our faith is shaken and sometimes completely crumbles. What we were once so sure about, our beliefs and assumptions about God and each other, now lie in ruins. All matter of circumstance can cause our life to be shaken apart. Global injustice and human brutality like that in Sierra Leone, economic insecurity, community breakdown, betrayal, divorce, illness, death, tragedy of all kinds often leaves us grasping for answers and getting only silence in return, or worse, more heartache. In the aftermath of our life being shaken apart by circumstances, we are brought lower than we ever thought we could go. We realize we actually don't hold the answers or the power to fix all of these circumstances, let alone ourselves. We're brought to our knees or flat on our back, realizing how desperate our human condition really is. It's at this point in the spiritual journey that we ask, "What can God do for me? What can God do for me?" You see, when we are brought low, God can really do something with us. Like the Apostle Paul affirms, our strength is made perfect in weakness. But it's our weakness that is hardest to face and embrace. And so we do all kinds of things to avoid looking at it. We need God's help to look at our weakness and vulnerability. If you've had if you've encountered an earth-shattering paradigm like this in your faith, take heart. It may seem terribly disorienting, but it's actually an invitation to deepen your faith and experience personal transformation, preparing you to be a better agent of change and transformation in our world. And if you've not yet questioned or wrestled with your faith or with God, take heart. If you are committed to the spiritual journey, to following Christ, no matter the cost, it will happen. And when it does, you will learn the paradoxical wisdom that freedom comes by surrender. Whatever the case, contemplative spirituality, tried and traditional contemplative prayer practices marked by solitude, silence, and stillness are absolutely imperative for a serious follower of Christ. Learning to pray with your whole self beyond words and thoughts catalyzes transformation and liberation. Contemplative spirituality is nothing new. It's actually very old and has been recovered for our time over the past 50 years by some courageous monks you may have heard of or been familiar with, like Thomas Merton, Thomas Keating, John Mayne, Bede Griffiths, and the friar Richard Rohr. Contemplative spirituality follows the spirit of Christ, who knew God as Abba, a very intimate connection leading to oneness with God, and the desire that all would be one, as illustrated in Jesus' prayer in the Gospel of John. Contemplative spirituality addresses particular needs for our time as we've grown increasingly hyperactive without a sense of balance for work and rest, constantly plugged into social media, leading to digital addiction and disconnection from authentic relationship. With so many options and opportunities, many of us are ironically struggling more than ever to have a strong sense of meaning and purpose for our life. We are desperate for discernment. Contemplative prayer liberates our authentic self, our truest self, the new creation part of us, and reveals how our true self is connected to God and everyone else, leading us to a richer, deeper, fuller life of meaning and purpose. By incorporating practices of solitude, silence, and stillness, contemplative spirituality addresses our personal and societal sickness, offering a kind of correction to the imbalance and depletion we're experiencing. So let's look a little closer at solitude, silence, and stillness. First, solitude. Though we're constantly dialed into social media, more connected with people around the planet than ever before, ironically, many of us have never felt more alone. While we may be digitally connected, we're not really present to one another, leaving us feeling terribly separated and isolated. The feeling of aloneness makes most of us very uncomfortable, leading our society to boast the highest rates of depression, anxiety, and suicide. So, what is the cure for our anxious-ridden loneliness? Ironically, practicing solitude. Now, certainly, there are important ways to address clinical depression and anxiety, like counseling, psychotherapy, and medication. But if we look at the trajectory of our overdeveloped society, we'll see that modernization has crowded out a healthy dose of solitude, as well as silence and stillness. We need to bring balance to what has become sorely out of balance. We have to learn how to be alone with ourselves and with God. For significant moments in our day, we must dare to detach from our digital appendages and deal with the anxiety it produces in us. God wants to meet us right there in our uncomfortability, loneliness, isolation, anxiety, and depression. Avoiding the inner darkness by keeping busy, hyperactively plugged in, doesn't make the pain go away. It only grows and secretly drains the life of our true self. In first century Palestine, scripture reveals that Jesus often withdrew to places of solitude to pray. If the Son of God acknowledged his need to withdraw from the busyness of his life to be alone with himself and God, who are we to resist such a practice? In solitude, we learn to be present. We learn to be present to ourself, to God, and to one another. As we let God heal our hidden neediness, anxiety, and pain, we experience more authentic connection to our true self, to God, and to others. Secondly, silence. If being alone is difficult, try being quiet. Most of us don't know how to be quiet. Even if we're allowing someone else to speak, while that person talks, we're often composing in our mind what we'll say when the other finally stops talking. We're not truly listening, right? Even now, for some of you listening to me, are you truly listening? Are you thinking about what I'm wearing, the lighting, what you're going to do after this is over, or 1,000 other distracting thoughts? If it's this difficult for us to listen to one another, how much more difficult must it be for us to listen to God? Do we even know what God's voice sounds like? God's voice is a sacred voice, calling, leading us in our vocation. The English word vocation is derived from the Latin word vocare, which means to name or to call, and vox, meaning voice. So the meaning of vocation centers on this. Our vocation is marked by listening to the voice calling us. But we can't listen if we're not quiet. And to get quiet, I mean really quiet from the inside out, we need to practice silence. Speaking to the burden of our human condition and our need for God, the writer of Lamentations writes, "The Most High is good to those who hope in God, to all who seek God's face. It is good to wait patiently for Yahweh to set us free. Let those who bear such a burden sit in silence." Practicing silence helps us develop the ability to listen and discern God's voice and leading. Third, stillness. "Be still and know that I am God," the psalmist passionately writes. Be still and know. Know that I am God. Many of us are so busy trying to change the world that we've neglected to change ourselves, to let ourselves be transformed by God's grace. And as our frenetic activity brings time to pass, we may find that many of our so-called good deeds actually cause more harm than good. Consider our sordid collective history as Christians. It's easy to look back and indict those before us who exploited and enslaved our African brothers and sisters in the name of God, and those who decimated an entire nation of people when colonizing the Americas in the name of God. And we can't forget the Crusades and the Inquisition, acts of exploitation, violence, and murder, all in the name of God. How will history indict us? Practicing stillness teaches us impulse control or restraint, restraining us from the impulses of our human nature that are secretly out of control, misdirected impulses that secretly motivate even our so-called good intentions. We may not recognize these impulses and probably don't, but they enslave us nonetheless. These unconscious impulses feed our hidden obsessive need for affirmation, control, and security, keeping us from freely giving of our highest and truest self to make our world a better place. Take a moment to consider how much you stew over what others think of you or say about you. Many of us have a compulsive need for affirmation. Consider the last time things didn't go the way you wanted or planned. How did you react? Did you experience surges of anger, frustration, fear, or anxiety? Many of us have a compulsive need for control. How about your concerns for your future? Do you ever obsess about or worry about how you'll pay your bills, acquire the basic necessities of life, or even how you'll keep a relationship that's important to you? Many of us have a compulsive need for security. Over time, as we practice stillness, we gain freedom from misguided impulses and are led to make greater impact for good in our family, community, and society. I recently returned from Rwanda, where Chris and I guided a group of pilgrims through the pain and hope of this remarkable country. This year marks the 20th memorial of the genocide that threatened to annihilate a nation of people. Perhaps some of you remember. 20 years ago, during Easter week, a systematic plan to kill every Tutsi man, woman, and child was unleashed. During the following 100 days, 1 million people were slaughtered with machetes, hammers, blunt objects, rocks, guns, by Hutu extremists, while the international community watched on our television sets and listened on the radio. Even though there was reported evidence of the genocide, the international community did nothing. During this gruesome display of human wickedness, a young Tutsi college student named Immaculée Ilibagiza hid in a 3-foot by 4-foot bathroom with 7 other women. Day by day, Immaculée was forced to keep complete silence and stillness in the solitude of this tiny bathroom. Crammed on top of one another, the women lived hour by hour in sheer terror as their would-be killers lurked outside the window and the hidden door. For 90 days, there was no peace, no relief from fear. Given only scraps of food, Immaculée grew more and more emaciated as time went on and her muscles atrophied and she contracted bodily infections. You can imagine the fear and anxiety she endured and the subsequent anger and hatred toward the killers that emerged. Thoughts of revenge and punishment tormented Immaculée. But by God's grace, early on, Immaculée gave herself to prayer and meditation. Hour by hour, minute by minute, Immaculée prayed a prayer of desperation. And that prayer of desperation turned to a prayer of oneness with God, a prayer beyond words and thoughts. It's how she stayed alive. When she finally was able to leave the secret bathroom that had been both a prison and a prayer cell, a forced solitude, silence, and stillness, Immaculée emerged with great faith and clarity for her life's purpose. Even though she soon learned about the brutal torture and murder of her father, mother, and beloved brothers, the prayer and meditation she experienced in hiding transformed her vengeance to forgiveness and hatred to love. Immaculée emerged from her captivity a physically and spiritually free woman with vision for not only her people, but for all people to live together in harmony and peace. She's devoted her life to sharing the message of love, forgiveness, and unity. And to encounter her is to encounter a person radiating the presence of God. Having survived such horrifying experiences in Rwanda, Immaculée writes and speaks all over the world, helping to elevate human consciousness in an effort to prevent another genocide. The United Nations defines genocide as acts committed with intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group. And given that during the 20th century alone, there were 31 genocides that took place across the planet, Immaculée's message is crucial. The loss of her family and friends and home, the physical and psychological trauma she endured do not define her. She is free. And the Spirit of God flows effortlessly through her to heal the world. Having literally descended the grave in her life circumstances, she was resurrected and given her divine purpose. Certainly, we would benefit from solitude, silence, and stillness, allowing particular time set apart to offer our bodies as living sacrifices, practicing total devotion to and surrender to God, being willing to descend the grave of our own life in the hopes of resurrection. By God's mercy, we won't be forced into solitude, silence, and stillness under horrific circumstances. But if we want to live with the clarity and vision and love and forgiveness that Immaculée lives with, we will heed the wisdom that comes from adopting contemplative practices. Remember the two questions that mark our spiritual journey? What can I do for God? And what can God do for me? The Apostle Paul so aptly describes our human condition in Romans 7. Why is it I don't do what I want to do, and what I don't want to do, that's the thing I do? When we wake up to our condition, to the reality of this battle within us between our true and highest self in Christ and our false or lower self, we are desperate for God to do something for us, to set us free. And not the kind of small freedom a child experiences at the first decision to follow Christ. I'm talking about a freedom that helps us as adults live our divine nature as children of God in such a way that the world is changed. I'm talking about a freedom that we see modeled in people like Gandhi, Mother Teresa, Martin Luther King Jr., and Nelson Mandela. Extraordinary personal freedom that changes the world. When we are ready for that kind of freedom, we identify with the blind man on the road to Jericho who cried out, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me, Jesus." And how does Jesus respond? "What can I do for you?" You see, Jesus never imposes. Always a gentleman, Jesus asks how he can be of help. And in his generous restraint, he gives us the opportunity to recognize our human condition, tap into our deepest desires, and ask for his touch. You see, self-awareness is the key to liberation. And so with the blind man, we can courageously respond to Jesus' question, "I want to see." Contemplative prayer practices marked by solitude, silence, and stillness help us see. And once our eyes are opened, we're never the same. With eyes wide open, we are fully alive, tapping into the abundant life that Jesus promises us. A life that, by the way, Jesus said, would do even greater things than he. During the second century, St. Irenaeus said, "The glory of God is a human being fully alive." Are you ready to be fully alive? Then help yourself wake up this weekend by embracing practices of solitude, silence, and stillness.
So we're going to close tonight with a practice that I think helps us learn to see differently. And so has anyone here ever done an Ignatian practice called the Examine? Good, okay, great. So I'm gonna introduce a little bit of history and context for some of you who don't know it, and then we're gonna just spend a few moments wrapping up this evening doing an examine together. So Ignatius of Loyola was born in the late 1400s, and as he became a young man, he found himself sort of in a really crucial time in history, right? It was the so-called discovery of the so-called New World. It was around the time of the Protestant Reformation. There was a lot of upheaval. And, right, God's timing is perfect, and I don't think when and where he was born was accidental. But Ignatius was sort of a career soldier, right? He was this hero and valiant, and he always looked for a fight. And it was during a battle in Pamplona, Spain, where they run the bulls that he was injured. And it's not funny, but he took a cannonball to the knee, which is probably something that doesn't happen much anymore. Anyway, old boy was in recovery. And as he was laid up, Ignatius loved to read stories of sort of the great heroes of war. All the books that were in that spot were about the lives of the saints and the Gospels, the life of Jesus. And so as Ignatius read and reread these books, he experienced a form of conversion. And in his conversion, he became inspired, and inspired by the lives of the saints, and in fact, specifically by the life of St. Francis of Assisi, and thought, why aren't we living like this? Where are the new modern current heroes of the faith? And sort of a side note is the Pope, right? The new Pope, a Jesuit, right? From the Society of Jesus, the order that Ignatius began. When he chose his name as the Pope, a lot of folks, I think, were surprised that he didn't choose Xavier or Ignatius or any of these other great Jesuit saints and heroes, but that he chose Francis, right? Pope Francis. But it makes sense in the spirit of the Ignatian tradition to live into the legacy of Francis of Assisi. And so that's what Ignatius and the brothers that he called around himself did, and they lived faithfully, prayerfully, building a better world. And as they did that, they mapped this journey of nurturing their spirituality. And they became They began offering retreats and formation experiences, and some of you may have done the exercises. But as people would go on these 30-day and sometimes longer retreats, there was a tool, there was a prayer that Ignatius wanted to leave folks with so that at the end of their retreat, when they went back to their normal life, the normal demands and strains, that they would have a practice to continue to help them develop discernment, right? And that was the examine. And so the examine is sort of a prayer that we pray that utilizes memory. It's a prayer of, it's not a prayer of clearing your conscience. Some of y'all need to clear your conscience. That's your deal. Do that. It's a prayer of consciousness, right? It's a prayer of learning to see the presence of God in our day and things that are very ordinary, mundane, routine. There's a Jesuit priest named Dennis Hamm, H-A-M-M, who wrote an article called Rummaging for God, right? Any of you ever read this? Rummaging for God? Dennis Hamm says that at the end of the day, when we're leaving our classrooms, our office, sometimes in the morning, when we're heading out to work, leaving our home, we stick our hand in our desk drawer, in our purse, and we rummage around looking for our keys, right? And tonight we've been talking a lot about seeing, finding new eyes. And when I'm looking for my keys in my desk drawer, I'm actually not using my eyes to find them, right? I'm looking with my hand. It's actually a bad word. It's a misuse of a metaphor. But as I rummage around, when I find my keys, I know what they are because I felt them. I recognize them with a different sense. And the examine is sort of a prayer that rummages for God in our day. But like I said, using memory, letting memory wash over us. And so there's five steps. There's five sort of movements to the traditional prayer. There's a prayer for enlightenment that is sort of centers us. It grounds us in that God's been present, that God is always with us. There's a reflective practice of thanksgiving, right? There's sort of a practical survey of our day, of actions that move us towards God and that move us away from God. And this is really the heart of the prayer of examine. Some of y'all probably practice a version of this without even realizing that the tradition. I know a lot of families do this with their kids at night. They tuck them in and are like, hey, what was the best part of your day and what was the worst part of your day? And essentially that's what the examine does, is it helps us find that consolation, that moment in our day where we felt most alive, most at peace, most centered, safe, loved, where we felt like we were resting. And that consolation is often really God speaking to us, God giving us a gift. And so sometimes we miss it, right? Sometimes your consolation might be that 10 minutes that you have alone in the car. Sometimes that consolation might be an amazing meal, or it might be a friend in your life, or it might be an experience playing with a little kid, or it might be just standing in the sunlight. Whatever it is, God is in that moment. And in fact, God is speaking to us. But a lot of us can't see that or hear that. Then we find a desolation, an attitude, a habit, a behavior, something that triggers in us movement away from God, where we resist God, we push God away, we refuse to sort of rest in the embrace of God. Right? The fourth movement of the prayer is sort of a pressing into the desolation with, for some of us it will be contrition, for some of us it will be sorrow, for some of us it will be courage, looking at that desolation as a gift, as an invitation. And then we close the prayer. The fifth movement of the prayer is sort of a hopeful resolution for tomorrow. That tomorrow, God will give us new opportunities to experience new consolations and new desolations. So those are the sort of five movements of the prayer. And for some of us, we like to journal. We like to write. We like to sit those five things down on a piece of paper in front of us and spend 10, 15, 20 minutes at the end of the day sort of writing this in. For others of us, We learn the movements of the prayer, and we allow ourselves to sort of, before we rest at night, rest our souls. What I'm going to do this evening, and I think we'll do it again tomorrow night, is I'll guide us through this, and really would just sort of encourage you to experience this prayer more as an attitude than an action. And so like Felina asked at the beginning, if you could find a posture that is attentive. We'll just take a couple minutes. Listen to your breath. We begin this examen affirming that God is with us, that God is near, that God is loving, kind, patient, full of grace, mercy, that God is not as hard on you as you are on yourself. And in allowing ourselves to be embraced by God, as we rest in God's love, recognizing that God invites us to receive more deeply, we move into the second portion of this prayer, posturing ourselves in gratitude, thankful for the gifts that we did and didn't see today, gifts that we did and didn't acknowledge today, thankful for friends, for family, for a church community, thankful for this pause in our busy lives. Thankful for the luxury of a retreat, a weekend away. Thankful for hot meals, soft beds. Thankful that we've made it this far, that we're still here together. And in the third movement of this prayer, we allow memory to take us back throughout the day. The moments where we woke up and got out of bed, prepared for the morning, packed up for a retreat, tied up loose ends, made our journey here, arriving, sharing a meal with friends, worshiping together. As we reflect and remember this day, we search for that consolation, that moment where we felt most alive, most centered, grounded, a moment of peace, a moment of comfort, that moment where we felt we could take a deep breath, that moment when we loved ourselves and allowed ourselves to be loved. Maybe it was the beauty of this place. Maybe it was the embrace of a friend, the smile of a child. Maybe it was something we ate, a song we heard, a memory we basked in. Whatever it is, we find that consolation. And in recognizing that consolation, we receive that as a gift. We examine it, looking for the message of love of what God was trying to speak to us, offer us, invite us into. And we also ask for the courage to identify a desolation, a moment where we felt alone or in the dark, frustrated, a moment that triggered something in us that we know we need to grow. A moment where we mistook the voices in the back of our heads of shame, of regret, of disappointment, of guilt, of fear, as if it was the voice of God. Whatever that desolation was, In the fourth movement of this prayer, we press into it, experiencing it as an invitation towards oneness, unity, union. And in facing that desolation, some of us confess attitudes, habits, behaviors. Some of us ask for mercy. Maybe we need strength or courage. Some of us are desperate just for hope. We offer that desolation to God. And in the final movement of this prayer, we rest. We rest in hope that tomorrow God will give us new opportunities to see, new opportunities to hear, new experiences of consolations and desolations. And in resting and in receiving these consolations as gifts and these desolations as invitations, we surrender ourselves into the loving embrace of a God who loves us more than we want to be loved.